This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of August the 29th, 2016. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. This week, we're going to be looking at some interesting new developments that have taken place in the week, this past week in the area of federal taxes. We've had some interesting developments here that deal with the IRS backing off the requirement that in order to sign up for the secure portal accesses, you're going to have a postpaid cell phone. They'll give options for other ways of getting signed up. We'll talk a bit as well, we talk about in this session, some additional other issues. We have the IRS did some real changes here to how taxpayers can get relief if they make a late contribution to their IRA account. So we'll have some issues there where if you have a late rollover, we now are going to have some ways to automatically get relief without having the IRS, without having to go and ask the IRS, please, please, please help us. We can do some other things to get there. We're going to find a few other issues this week. In fact, the IRS has opened up a sharing economy website that's going to be useful for some of our clients. We'll talk a bit about the taxpayer who had a problem because they couldn't prove their basis in their S corporation stock. That proved to be a problem for the taxpayer in question, and we'll discover how that worked out. And we have the publication of the average monthly bronze premium rates. That's going to impact taxpayers who are going to be potentially subject to these shared responsibility payments this year because that's one of the caps on your maximum shared responsibility payments. So we'll go ahead and we'll get this going. Now, this week, as we say, we're here in the season to be looking for signing up for courses, and we're quickly running into the fall. Wanted to let you know about some courses we're going to be doing this fall. First, in Ohio, Robert Gilwey on the September 19th and 20th will be doing a red flag issue in Toledo, and which talks about things that are, you know, major IRS issues we've seen in cases recently, and so therefore things that by definition, since cases only come from audits that have been audit issues, as well as pass-through entities advanced issues in Cleveland on September 20th. I will be in the state of Iowa in Sioux City on September 22nd, doing a course for assisting the survivors in the decedent's estate, and on September 23rd, doing a course with fringe benefits in Sioux City. Butch Rogers will have the same course, oil and gas taxation, landowners and investors. He'll do it on the 26th in Dallas, Texas, and on the 27th, he'll go down to Houston and present the course. Again, take a look at the relevant state society websites. If you're going to be in those areas, you might want to take a look at signing up for those courses and starting to do a little bit of work here because, hey, time's coming now. We're getting into the tack, we're getting into the season, and it's time to start getting ready as we have a little bit of a break here between the September 15th deadlines and the October 15th deadline. So we have a little bit of time here to hopefully allow us to spend some time getting a bit of training in the interim. So go ahead and take a look at those courses. Let's go to our first development this week. And that's going to be that the IRS has now relented on the phone requirements for signing up for secure services online. This was found via a website announcement done on August the 15th. On the IRS's website, they originally, remember, we told you about this a couple weeks ago, they've reestablished certain secure systems that had been problems with breaches, or not really breaches, but unauthorized access, shall we say. And they went back in under their new system. They were going to require for taxpayers to prove they really are the taxpayer. They were going to send a code out to the taxpayer via their cell phone. Now, to have that cell phone, you had to have a prepaid cell phone account. Well, that's great, except A, some elderly taxpayers simply don't have cell phones. There's a pretty good percentage that actually don't. B, even those that do may not have a text-enabled one because they've never gotten into texting. And C, if you have a postpaid system, such as from somebody like Cricket, or you have a system that may be a VoIP-based system like Google Voice or Skype, while you can receive text, it won't work for this purpose. Now the IRS, and this actually followed up on a problem the Social Security Administration had where they got a lot of pushback where they're going to require the same thing. Now you can sign up and elect to use, instead of having to go on and use a postpaid phone, the IRS now agrees that, okay, well, we can just send this to you by mail. So instead of doing a phone, we can do it by mail. So they're going to send mail codes by default, or not by default, but if you request, to taxpayers who will then enter that code to prove they're there. The code will be sent to the taxpayer's last known address. Now, the taxpayer will still need to have, which is going to be a bit of a problem if you don't have a phone, a text-enabled phone because whenever they try to sign on to the service, they will have to provide the code to prove it hasn't been breached. But at least at a minimum, they'll be able to get on the system without having to have a postpaid account. Generally, that would require an account with one of the big four carriers in the U.S. or one of the regionals that has postpaid options. The reason for that was because when you do get a postpaid phone and you go to, let's say, Verizon and sign up for a traditional postpaid account, Verizon runs a credit check on you, and that helps verify you're you. If you get a postpaid account, like with something like with, we talk about Project 5 from Google, if you get a postpaid account, then they don't really run that credit check because you only get service for this month if you pay for this month. So that's kind of the way we're going to be working this now. So there's a little bit of an easier way for clients who maybe don't have the postpaid, but they're still going to have a way to get that text message. Next up, we'll be considering a case here that where we talked from the IRS standpoint. We're going to go on and take a look at the IRS has proposed to increase the cost for installment agreements. As you may be aware, the IRS charges a fee to taxpayers who look to enter into an installment agreement. Well, the IRS in Regulation 108-792-16 issued on August 19th of 2016, is proposing to raise the fees beginning on January 1st, 2017, and to add a few new options for there. The bottom line of this is generally the fees are going to increase, but there will be a, quote, cheap option if you can set up the account entirely online and you choose direct debit. Generally, a regular installment agreement, which you go ahead, you know, you apply for on paper and you ask for them to basically allow you to send in checks, that's going to increase from $120 for the fee to set that up to $225. A direct debit account is going to rise to $107 from $52. If you have a new online agreement, that will be $149 if you ask to pay by check, $31 for direct debit. If you're going to have a restructuring because you violated the agreement, they're going to have to restructure the agreement, that's going to be an additional $89 fee. They will still allow, if you're a low-income taxpayer, you can prove you meet the requirements for that, that fee will remain at $43, which is the current fee. The IRS justified this by telling us that under the current system, the IRS was charging fees that were not sufficient to recover the cost of the program. The IRS generally for user fees is supposed to be recovering the cost. That's the idea of a user fee. So they're now moving to a user fee to recover the full cost of setting up an installment agreement. They had said previously they didn't do that to encourage people to pay up. Now apparently we're not going to encourage them as much. So if you're not a low-income taxpayer qualified, we're going to have you pay more unless you can go to the online system, you qualify to use that, and you agree to have it taken directly out of a bank account through direct debit. That's going to be the one case where there's going to be a cheaper option under the new proposal than exists under the current proposal. But otherwise, it's going to cost you more if your client decides they're going to be doing an installment agreement. Next up, the IRS opened up a sharing economy tax center on their website on August the 22nd. The sharing economy, for those of you who may not have kind of picked up on what that means these days, if you don't know the lingo, that deals with services like Uber, Lyft, Airbnb, where effectively we have these people sharing their car, sharing their home or, you know, a room or whatever, putting it out on the internet. So that we have these people who aren't used to being in business necessarily, now essentially going in business for themselves, because all of these are going to essentially be treated not as employees by most of these enterprises, but are going to be treated as independent contractors. Now, filing for as an independent contractor in Schedule C is something that most taxpayers don't have to do, and many taxpayers may be confused about their requirements. Because of that, the IRS has set up a web page that outlines a whole bunch of issues that such individuals should have to face from a federal standpoint. This website is actually a useful resource for clients who are in the sharing economy, because those clients can go ahead and make use of all of the, you know, have to worry about filing requirements, potential issues. Are they employees, not employees? Do they hire employees, which they could end up doing in the wrong situation here? You know, what are all their issues to worry about? Now, the one thing to remind clients who are in the sharing economy is that's fine. This deals with your federal requirements, but there may very well be state-specific requirements we need to worry about for you. And if there are state-specific requirements, they're not going to be covered on this site. So your clients probably want to go ahead and ensure that in addition to checking the federal requirements, you want to check the state both from a tax standpoint and sometimes from a regulatory standpoint as to what may be required if your client's going to be in the quote-unquote sharing economy. Next up, a revenue procedure, because I believe the IRS got tired of essentially writing private letter rulings. This is Revenue Procedure 2016-47, issued on August the 24th. This deals with the situation where a taxpayer takes a distribution from a qualified retirement plan or from their IRA, and they have 60 days to complete a rollover. And for whatever reason, that rollover doesn't get completed. Generally, you're just sort of out of luck if that's what happened. But the IRS was given the authority a number of years ago to authorize themselves to effectively give certain relief if the IRS, you know, relief and allow people to make late rollovers. The problem with that was, except for one particular fact situation back in the old revenue procedure, 2000, back in those issues, in limited situations that we had in the prior revenue procedure, we effectively always had to go get a private letter ruling. One thing that we discovered is that many cases, those rulings, you know, they were pretty much standard. They were all, we became, certain things you came to know would always get relief. Well, the IRS has kind of noticed that now. So now they're going to allow a taxpayer to self-certify. If you self-certify, you must have one of 11 reasons as to why you failed to complete the rollover. Those reasons include an error was committed by the financial institution receiving the contribution or making the distribution to which the contribution relates. And that was actually the only automatic excuse you had under the old ruling. The distribution being made in form of a check was misplaced and never cashed. The distribution was deposited into and retained an account the taxpayer mistakenly thought was a retirement plan. They put it into a regular savings account instead of an IRA account that was going to be a CD. That happens quite a lot. The taxpayer's principal residence was severely damaged and prevented them from completing the rollover on time. A member of the taxpayer's family died. The taxpayer or member of the family was seriously ill. Getting arrested will help you here, apparently. One of the few things that helps you with, because if you're incarcerated, that also will qualify you for this automatic relief. You had restrictions imposed by a foreign country that blocked you from doing the rollover. There was a postal error. It got lost in the mail. That occurred. The distribution was made by account of a levy by the IRS and the funds have been returned to you that were taken from the IRA account. Or the party making the distribution to which the rollover relates delayed providing information that the receiving plan or IRA required to complete the rollover despite the taxpayer's reasonable attempts to get that information in a timely fashion. Now, the taxpayer has to show that they corrected the problem as soon as was practicable when the thing that prevented them from completing the rollover disappeared. For instance, they became aware they had it in a regular savings account. By definition, the IRS will say if you do that within 30 days, that will always be deemed to be a reasonable time period. If you go beyond 30 days, then it's a facts and circumstances situation. You also cannot have previously been denied relief by the IRS for the question. So you couldn't have applied for a letter ruling, been turned down, and then used this. How you make this work is you give the financial institution a letter. There is an example letter the IRS concludes with this particular revenue procedure. We have a copy of that letter in the PDF we published for this week. So if you want to go grab that PDF, you can find the example letter right there. And what you do is you check one of the boxes. You sign it, you know, stating that you believe this to be true. The financial institution can rely on that letter as long as they don't know for some reason that it's false, that you're lying to them. And this will, by definition, grant you a waiver of the rollover, but you are subject to later IRS examination. They are going to change the 5498. So a financial institution will have to tell the IRS if they have accepted a rollover outside the 60-day period. So we're going to have to kind of, you know, the IRS will be on notice about this, but it will be one where the IRS has to examine and show that you either misstated the facts in this certification to the bank or, you know, you didn't move reasonably fast enough as you were supposed to make this go. This is going to be useful because previously the cost of a private letter ruling might have dissuaded a lot of clients from fixing this. Also, to be completely honest, if they somehow could find that to be that the advisor was at blame or that the financial institution was at blame, a lot of financial institutions or advisors could end up having to pay for the private letter ruling expense. So this also can solve those person's problems. This is effective August 24th. So if you have a client that you find has had a botched rollover for their IRAs, remember this rule. Once you discover the problem, though, you've got 30 days to fix it. So you still have to get the rollover done, but you can solve the problem by using this letter, and you'll be deemed to have late rollover relief. A useful relief provision the IRS has added. Next up, we're going to take a look at a court case. This is the case of Power versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-157. This was released on August the 21st. So on August the 21st of 2016, we have this wonderful new program that came into place. In this case, we have a taxpayer who basically had a real estate S corporation. He was basically ran a brokerage through the S corporation. This particular one ran into some trouble. And for a while, he had a person on his staff who didn't have any accounting training that helped him keep the books. But then he had to let that person go, so he started keeping the books. The court case doesn't actually say, but given the title of the reports they were working off of, it appears he started using Quicken to keep track of his income and expenses, but it was very, very informal. He had minimal records of what he did. The tax court noted that, you know, for many years he had not taken salaries, but he had taken distributions. He also had not kept a running total of the basis of the stock in his S corporation. The IRS came in, examined him, found he had a number of distributions, and in this case, they weren't going to actually say it was salary, which is a little bit unusual, but we're not going down the payroll tax route here. Rather, they said these represented taxable gains, distributions to him. Now, most likely they did, because I suspect he had no written note, and the IRS is going to tax these as ordinary income. So from the IRS's perspective, it's like, yeah, we don't have to fight the payroll issue here. We'll just go ahead and do ordinary income and, you know, not worry about that aspect of it. We'll go ahead and we'll give up the FICA. We'll get the income tax, because probably that income tax examiner who wasn't going to be very, very concerned about making the payroll case because he felt he had a slam dunk here on the income case. The taxpayer said, wait, these were distributions. And, well, I'm sure I had basis. Well, of course, he had no records on that right away. So what happens is they go back and they attempt to reconstruct the basis. They reconstructed the basis using his old tax returns. The tax court said, well, that's not relevant. You know, that in essence, that's not sufficient. We need records to back this up because we have reason to believe, looking at the records you have now, we have reason to doubt potentially, you know, how well structured that is. They also note that they claimed they had no distributions in prior years. And of course, the court was concerned, how was he living? And we kind of admitted we were taking distributions rather than the salaries to live on. We had personal expenses we knew that had been deducted in that he'd been attempting to deduct the current year. So the tax court said, we know you have this computation that you had barely enough basis to cover these distributions, but you know what? We don't believe it. In essence, the burden's on you to show that you had adequate basis. We believe that you have not adequately met that burden in this case. And so because of that, we are not going to allow you to claim return a basis for any of these distributions. Rather, you're required to pay tax on the full amount of the distribution. The real lesson here, of course, is that records count. And the other side effect here is, remember, in proving basis, you really do have to be able to go back to the first day the taxpayer got an investment in the S corporation or partnership. If push comes to shove and we have reason to believe that some of these, you know, that there may be errors, you know, like, for instance, you're reporting income, you're reporting as deductions now, things that clearly aren't deductions, the court may very conclude that you might have done that in the past, that should have been distributions. They may also conclude that in the past you reported no distributions, but we see your records are kind of flaky and maybe things just don't work the way we think they should. You've got to be able to go back to day one to prove this. Now, you almost, you know, in reality, let's be practical. If you've been keeping running basis calculations and you've been attaching those to the return, which, by the way, if you've been claiming losses, you should have been doing for an S corporation, then you probably won't be challenged. But if you're like this taxpayer, never have considered the basis issue, don't be surprised if the courts and the IRS want to go back to the first day you started this enterprise. Because if you haven't been keeping track of it, they probably think there's a decent, you know, the odds are pretty decent. If you haven't been watching it, and you've been doing like he's been doing, taking large distributions, well, there's a decent chance that you actually don't have any basis in this enterprise. And that, of course, creates a little problem for us. Finally, Let's go ahead and take a look at Revenue Procedure 2016-43. This was issued on August 19th of this year. And what it does, it gives us the average monthly bronze premiums for 2016, I should say. Now, under the provisions for the shared responsibility payment found that was adopted as part of the Affordable Care Act, one of the caps on the maximum penalty that could be imposed on a taxpayer is the average bronze premium that they could have just paid. The theory is we're not going to penalize them more than the cost of the insurance they could have had. Now, generally, the penalty is a flat dollar amount, which would be $695 for 2016 divided by 12. So, you know, you end up doing that. If you're over 18, it's one. If you're under 18, it's one half of that. So for each person you should have covered with a maximum family amount, or 300% of the applicable dollar amount for the year is your cap. The secondary rule is a percentage of your household income set at 2.5%. So, you know, if the 2% number is greater than the annual limitation, then you get taxed on that. So the real cap here is the monthly amount. If you're, it's 2% of income, now it's high enough, what's the monthly cap? This year, the monthly cap for 2016 for individual coverage will be $2,203. And if you're looking at somebody who should have had family coverage that is covering more than one person, then we're looking at $1,115. Again, remember, this serves as one of the caps there. Primarily, it's going to hit the people for whom the 2% of income number is going to be higher than what we see under the default shared responsibility payment, because the default responsibility payment is less than these numbers anyway. In that case, please remember that we've got this secondary cap when doing projections. You may have some clients, I know I've run into them, who simply don't want to buy the insurance out of, you know, they just don't want to buy that. They, you know, they've never thought it. They've always self-insured. They have high net worth and they just don't believe, you know, they believe that the insurance company is just going to rip them off. So those people, you have to remember this shared responsibility payment cap. Normally, it's not going to affect people who didn't pay for it because, you know, their income went way down and they just couldn't afford it. Their answer is, because if you really don't have any income, you can't afford it, then this cap's never going to make a difference to you. Rather, you're going to be looking at a cap that is based on the amount that you put in. You're going to be looking at the standard cap limitation. Okay, so this is one of those things that you just kind of remember. As always, please remember, this is brought to you, and the reason we can do this is based on the work of the state CPA societies. The state CPA societies provide you with many opportunities to get full-day, excellent training to keep yourself educated so that you can serve your clients and serve your clients' interest. Be sure to check your state CPA society's website for all of the offerings that they have, and be sure to support that, because supporting your state CPA society, in addition to getting great education, your state CPA societies also tend to, in almost every state, they're also the way that you as a CPA are able to be represented before various entities like your state legislature. And, you know, they usually have interests where they, you know, will raise issues if there are issues at the State Board of Accountancy, where they may be talking about regulations and stuff. These are things that are useful for you to support. And one of the ways you support that is by taking education through your state CPA society. So be sure to go out and check your website for all of those things. Okay. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of August the 29th. As always, current federal tax developments brought to you by your state CPA societies and those of us here at Nichols Patrick CPE. You want to make sure that you check on our website. We have a couple of things there. You want to make sure that you check our website. We have a PDF of articles on all today's topics, so that has the example letter there for the late IRA rollover and the requirements that we'll meet and what, you know, in essence, what excuses work. It also has the new fees for the installment agreement, the caps on the bronze, on the premiums for the shared responsibility payment. So there's a lot of useful reference information this week. You want to make sure to also check currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com all during the week, because we're going to post updates as things happen in taxes, so you can find out about that. You can send any questions or comments to me at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, or you can follow me on Twitter, and my handle there is @edzollers. We look forward to seeing you next week as we talk about the developments that take place in the area of federal taxes.